Chapter 3. Cynical Rage, Demagogues, Charlatans, Emotional Predators. Gerard, the first day's patient, is readying himself on the couch. I look over, noticing the knotting of his brow, the squeeze of his lowered eyelids, and feel the air between us thicken. Gerard is beset by physical and emotional afflictions that stick to each other like a codependent couple. Crippling headaches and insomnia merge inexorably with his fear of being consigned to permanent, irremediable loneliness. He frequently discharges this double malaise in breathless monologues, fraught with panic and rage. Gerard begins today by telling me it's just not working with Amanda, the woman he's been seeing for the last couple of months. He tried to tell her what it's like carrying these pounding headaches through the working day, practically hallucinating after another sleepless night. But she doesn't really get it. Barely 2 months, and she's fed up. And who can blame her? He goes on to rail against the dating apps he's forced to use and their steady drip feed of misinformation, out-of-date pictures, misleading self-descriptions, sometimes outright lies. Whom does any of it benefit beyond the platforms themselves, venal parasites on human vulnerability? I can feel his breath quicken as he inveighs against people's preferences to present themselves as generic fictions online rather than as fleshly human beings in the real world, which leads him in turn to me, no doubt possessed of a lovely wife and adorable children, feeling sorry for him. Well, he doesn't need my pity. He won't be patronised. Oh, and speaking of which, did I see Boris fucking Johnson's puffed-up speech in Parliament yesterday? How do the people of this country tolerate that hideous tone of entitled condescension? He wants to grab a tuft of that mussy blonde hair and bang his forehead on the desk till his skull cracks. Gerard rants with a force that seems to exceed the causes he names. As I listen, I have the thought that something is out of sequence. It's not that he thinks of the dating app or Johnson and is made furious, more that he's grabbing at irritants to make sense of a fury that's there from the moment he wakes up. Freud observes a similar confusion about the sexual drive. When we fall in love, the powerful rush of tender and erotic feelings we experience fosters the belief in an intimate and direct relationship between the drive, that strange impulsion to love, and the object, the person we love. Hence the myth of the one true love. But this is an illusion. The variety, unpredictability, and volatility of our loving feelings tell us that, on the contrary, the sexual drive and the sexual object are merely soldered together. The drive is a desire desperately seeking the thing that will satisfy it. Occasionally, it finds an object that makes it think, okay, perhaps this is what I'm looking for. This seems to me very much how Gerard's anger was behaving, a free-floating, diffuse force that powered through the world searching for the cause that would explain it, bring him the relief of saying, this is why I'm so angry. But like a restless and fickle lover, no sooner would he identify one object of his rage than another came into view. Then another, and another. Gerard's anger was wildly promiscuous. If rage is so insatiable, how do any of us manage to keep it within bounds? How is it possible to live with a force that agitates us so powerfully so much of the time? I've been arguing throughout this book that aggression is more primary than anger, that anger comes about only when we allow ourselves to feel our response to a provoking object rather than discharge those feelings in reflexive action. But it doesn't always feel this way in real time. It can often seem as though anger, as it gathers momentum in us, impels us towards action, or what we commonly call aggression. In fact, in such cases, we've tried to confine our anger to the psychic realm, to feel and think it rather than act it out, only for it to reach a pitch so overwhelming that we feel we can keep it in no longer. We simply must yell, punch, smash. The capacity to stay with anger as a purely internal state is what prevents the rush into blind action. We lash out in hot verbal or physical aggression when we can no longer represent our anger to ourselves, when we can no longer bear the pressure it is exerting on our minds. If, on the other hand, we can gain sufficient mental distance from our anger to be curious about it, to ask what it's about and how it might be relieved, then rather than being the midwife to aggression, anger can promote self-reflection and stay the automatic impulse to aggression. This isn't to say, of course, that anger can't or shouldn't lead to decisive action, perhaps even to aggression. But in self-reflective anger, action collaborates with the mind instead of overriding it. A boy shouts at the best friend, who he suddenly realizes has just swiped the chocolate bar from his lunchbox as his back was turned. The friend, still chewing the last of the bar, smiles mischievously, sheepishly apologizes, and promises to buy him another. Because the source of the anger is immediately clear and relief quickly follows, the loss inflicted is felt as minor and temporary. But what if, instead, the entire lunchbox is grabbed from him daily by a bigger boy who menaces him with the prospect of untold tortures if he tells? Feeling bound to comply, the boy's anger is overridden by his fear. This is the bullied child's predicament. In his own mind, at least, he is forbidden to tell, to voice his experience in the form of a story. Denied representation, his anger gradually becomes a mute, formless mass, spreading through his interior, casting its shadow over his daily life. If this experience goes unaddressed for too long, the man the boy becomes is likely to struggle to bear his anger, to find a language which lends it shape and form. When it can be spoken and heard, D.W. Winnicott suggests, anger contributes to our developmental health. A hungry baby's cry is a kind of primary anger, an assertion of a fundamental need. This, Winnicott says, is a positive, if very rudimentary, statement of the infant's determination to live his way, to be led by his own needs rather than adapt to another's. When a cry achieves its aim, for example when the mother feeds her baby in response, it helps him learn what his anger is for. But a cry that is met by indefinite delay and neglect, that has no discernible effect on the adult's hearing it, has the opposite effect. The individual, says Winnicott with characteristic understatement, is left with some confusion about anger and its expression. This confusion is akin to what is later experienced by the bullied child, an injury that has no means of being told or heard. The more unintelligible his experience, the more his anger diffuses and intensifies. Like the hungry baby, he is seeking ever more desperately for a satisfying response that doesn't arrive. When I think of Gerard, I can't help seeing an eerie continuity with these two figures. His rants about his physical ailments, or women, or the horrors of digital life, or the political class, are arrows in search of a target. It's as though he's seeking the one antagonizing object that will finally satiate his rage and bring it to an end. But none of them do, which might explain why sessions with him can feel like a punishing eternity, but also, and somehow at the same time, swallowed up in an instant. I often find myself wondering what he wants from me, simply to provide a space into which he and his anger can expand? Perhaps that would explain the mental image that has at times assailed me during sessions, the room suddenly occupied by a monstrous grey inflatable, expanding so quickly that it raises me aloft and threatens to push my face up into the ceiling, the torrents of air squashing my nose against the plaster. Faced with this feeling of inexorable suffocation, it's tempting to let myself be drawn into whatever personal or political or moral controversy he might be trying to provoke, to disagree, perhaps, and so force him to recognize me as a separate person rather than an empty vessel for his ire. Or agree, and enjoy the solidarity of shared rage and frustration, affirming his conviction that the world is indeed cruel and stupid and infuriating. Yes, let's take turns banging Boris Johnson's head on the desk. Why do neither of these approaches work? The most basic premise of clinical psychoanalysis, known as transference, is that the patient's responses to the analyst are repeating a much older pattern of relating. If the analyst isn't aware of this tendency, they are likely to perpetuate this repetition instead of resolving it. For Gerard, the possibilities of agreement and disagreement would immediately conjure up the spectre of his late father, a celebrated QC whose withering style of argument carried over reliably from court to home. Gerard's mother, herself, regularly put down by her husband for the alleged crudity and illogic of her thinking, would laughingly recall to the older Gerard his father's exasperated correction of his grammar and syntax from the age of 2. I tried to tell him that it was natural for a toddler to speak as you did, but he'd always insist you were never too young to learn. As Gerard got older, each new stage in the development of his speech and writing and thinking would be shadowed by his father's unsparing correction. Gerard's every idea or opinion would be mercilessly dissected for errors of expression and consistency, for inadequate evidence, or political immaturity, or lack of independence of mind. Gerard was alive to the irony of the last criticism. "For God's sake," his father would hiss at him, as the adolescent Gerard dejectedly argued his case against Thatcherite economics or for electoral reform. "Why not try to use your own mind for once, instead of lifting some poorly digested phrases from the latest Guardian leader?" But how could any son of such a father be expected to have a mind of his own? Gerard had dragged himself through school, university, and a range of careers under a cloud of self-doubt and inhibition, intellectual, creative, and social. Always anticipating the disdain of teachers, peers, and colleagues, he would revert to a resentful silence. If he gave himself freedom to speak, his mind would only let him down. Better to keep quiet. Gerard came to identify with his father, taking over from him the unending task of putting himself down. But alongside this attitude of impatient contempt towards himself, he nursed a rage towards the world, whose pleasures and ambitions he could never enjoy. He would scorn the world that scorned him. He couldn't trust himself to play or dream or love. He trusted only the weary hopelessness that powered his endless rants. And his rage ensured that I was merely the latest in a series of characters who would confirm and amplify his father's dim view of him. My silence didn't fool him, he told me. He knew just what I was thinking, so why not say it? That he was a grown man, having his pathetic daily toddler tantrum, unable to control himself or exercise the smallest power of reason. Over the course of an analysis, the analyst will come to be experienced by the patient, sometimes consciously, more often not, as an avatar of key figures from earlier stages of their life. A parent at one moment, a teacher at another, a sibling, a friend, a lover, a colleague, or a composite of two or more of these, the aforementioned transference. Transference often arouses unruly intensities of feeling in the patient. The analyst is liable to become an object of love, hate, trust, mistrust, fear, comfort, reverence, or contempt, often within a single session. But underlying all of these feelings is a profound sense of dependency, derived from the earliest period of life when our very survival depended on the ministrations of our carers. When Gerard lies down on the couch, he experiences me as possessed with the power to make him or break him with a few words. This awareness of his vulnerability to my judgment magnifies both his anxiety and his anger. How has he landed back in a room with his father? And this alerts me in turn to the power with which the role of analyst endows me. Both characters in the analytic drama are alive to the patient's impulse to please and mollify the analyst, as well as the wish to sabotage and reject what they offer. I can feel in my bones both the deep relief that can be aroused in Gerard by my smallest affirmative hum, and the intense dismay felt when he hears me question or doubt him. The basic scenario of psychoanalysis is fraught with power and all its attendant anxieties. A person brings the most vulnerable and hidden region of their psyche and places it in the care of the analyst, in the hope that this gesture of trust will not be abused or exploited. But the anxiety implied in this hope can never be fully dispelled. How can I know the analyst is my ally? What if their show of benign curiosity and availability are subtly disguised forms of control and manipulation? Framed in this way, the risks of the psychoanalytic relation bear a striking resemblance to the risks of the political relation. Machiavelli's core teaching in The Prince, that every ruler must be at peace with his people, reminds us that governance by autocrat and democrat alike is sustainable only on the basis of at least a minimal bond of trust. The autocrat must assure his subjects that their interests are best served by submitting to his absolute sovereignty. The Democrat must persuade her citizens that their interests are best served by voting her into office. In short, a citizen needs to see herself, her own aspirations and wishes represented in her leader. The spreading crisis of social division today stems from the betrayal of this need. In liberal democracies across the world, it seems that close to half of the citizenry look at their political class and see in it no recognition of the reality of their own lives and hopes, a phenomenon that has oiled the wheels of the authoritarian demagogues' rise. The longer and more completely rulers are perceived by the populace to be failing them, the greater the eventual risk of civil unrest. At such moments, the rulers can unleash the machinery of state power, the police, the courts, the secret services, against its angry citizens. But as Hannah Arendt reminds us, a ruling class's reliance on this threat of violence signifies weakness rather than strength, a breakdown of the basic contract that grounds political consent, and an implicit admission that their governance is failing. It's no accident that the metaphor of parenthood abounds in the discussion of analytic and political trust alike. There are many good reasons to find the metaphor objectionable in both contexts. Neither analytic patients nor political citizens want to be thought of as frustrated or angry children making demands of their harassed parents. Both are more often mature individuals struggling with the social and personal responsibilities of adult life. And yet the metaphor isn't entirely without value. When we petition or protest against the state, or approach an analyst for help, we are speaking out of our child as much as our adult selves. The adult, after all, has been primed by successive institutions, from family to school to workplace, to keep a lid on their frustrations in the name of compliance and self-preservation. The child is the force in us that refuses to do this, to sacrifice its own needs and wishes for those of the adults. Perhaps this accounts for the global resonance of Greta Thunberg as an exemplary protester of our time. Thunberg's anger disarms us because of its childlike directness and clarity, which she has ascribed to the autism she calls her superpower. Youth and autism together ensure that her message is unadulterated by the hedges of a jaded realism. Thunberg's uncompromising impatience with the global political class alerts us to the uncomfortable truth that in the face of lethal planetary emergency, the adult stance of caution and reason starts to look like the utmost madness, not to say childishness. So many of us have found in her grave outrage an uncannily accurate representation of our own feelings, as though she were revealing an intimate link between the child and political anger. To insist on this link is not to characterize political anger as infantile. It is rather to suggest that to become meaningfully adult, we must retain contact with the child we were and remain. We become jaded and cynically indifferent at the point we silence the child in us, the voice that laments and revolts against the world's failure to hear our basic needs and deepest wishes. Thunberg unabashedly gives expression to both, the need for the species to survive, but also the wish for a future worth having. The Italian psychoanalyst Massimo Recalcati suggests that the predicament of youth in our age of moral chaos, lawlessness and loss of meaning, is not, as in the classical Oedipus complex, having to manage the desire to kill and replace the father. Instead, he suggests, younger generations are in the grip of a Telemachus complex. Telemachus is the son of Odysseus, waiting on the island of Ithaca for the return of his father, 20 years absent from home. In his father's absence, the Procae, meaning suitors of Penelope, have invaded and usurped the family home, rampaging through its halls, ransacking its food, and raping the female servants. Telemachus must endure and hold off the attack while searching over the horizon for Odysseus to return and restore order and justice to the ravaged home. Doesn't Recalcati capture precisely the nature of the anger animating Thunberg and her generation of climate protesters? Their demand is not murderous, not the expression of a drive to kill and usurp the older generation, but a desperate cry across the horizon to the parents who have gone quiet or missing while the planetary home has been violated and ransacked. The anger is directed toward not disposing of the parents, but bringing them back to where they're most needed. It is because of her unapologetic youth that we confer on Thunberg a license to speak truths we feel too compromised to voice ourselves. She becomes a projection of the honesty and straightforwardness worn away in us by the shabby complicities of adulthood. She can express our sense of the wholesale betrayal of our political trust and the demand it be regained by representing the most basic interest of humanity. The protesting Telemachus of today doesn't so much refuse adult authority as demand that it become and remain worthy of its own status. Global political mistrust in the political class begins in the failure to listen to that demand. Thunberg is such a potent embodiment of that mistrust because she tells a resonant story about it. In the face of an emergency that demands the unequivocal force of black and white thinking, she is endowed with an exemplarily black and white mind. Under her gaze, the politicians, pundits, and lobbyists who obfuscate the urgency of global heating by raising doubts about the science or insisting on a balance between environmental and economic concerns are exposed as a parade of naked emperors whose clothes the rest of us are pretending to see. From this angle, Thunberg's years of hunger and school strikes look less like overblown adolescent rage than the proper reaction for anyone who perceives reality without the defensive filters of denial and complacency. Her anger is calibrated tightly to the scale of the outrage she is addressing. Because anger follows the relentless logic of the drive, feeding off its own proliferating dissatisfactions, it is liable to have a numbing effect on its audience, as Gerard reminds me. Instead of a means to voice the specific sources of his unhappiness, anger had become Gerard's way of life, the air he breathed. From his first raging thought of the day to the arousal of the furies of his dreaming mind, his anger was frantically searching for and failing to find a form that would make it intelligible to himself and to everyone else. "I want to give myself a rest from all this agitation," he told me. "Living in my head is hell, like playing an unending game of whack-a-mole." The role of a psychoanalyst is to help Gerard bring this hellish game to a stop. But what if the analyst chooses instead to use their privilege as the recipient of the patient's anger to manipulate and exploit it? A particularly egregious version of this scenario played out in a 30-year therapeutic relationship narrated by The Shrink Next Door, a hugely popular podcast of 2019 adapted for TV by Apple in 2021. The podcast was written and presented by journalist Joe Nocera and begins in 2010 when Nocera and his wife were sent a formal invitation via the neighbour's handyman to tea at his neighbour's vacation home in the Hamptons. The neighbour was Isaac Ike Hirschkopf, a New York psychiatrist evidently enamoured of high living and celebrity. The walls of his home were lined with rows of framed photographs showing Ike embracing Gwyneth Paltrow, Elton John, Henry Kissinger and O.J. Simpson, alongside hundreds of other members of Hollywood, political and pop music royalty. Unimpeachably gracious hosts, Ike and his wife had the same handyman serve tea. Only the following summer did Nocera discover that the handyman, Marty Markowitz, was in fact the house's owner and Hirschkopf's patient of 30 years. During the intervening year, Markowitz had ejected his long-term houseguest and ended their intricately entangled therapeutic, social, and financial relationship. Nocera goes on to unfold a startling story of control and exploitation. At the time of his first consultation with Hirschkopf in 1981, Markowitz had recently lost his parents, broken off an engagement, and inherited ownership and control of their family business, a fabric supplier to theatres. Overwhelmed by self-doubt and beset by familial rivalries over control of the inherited business, Markowitz was sent by his rabbi to the young psychiatrist, who ended the consultation proposing 3 times weekly psychotherapeutic sessions and assuring Markowitz he would, as Markowitz recalls it, take care of everything. Over the 3 decades that followed, Hirschkopf was as good as his word. He assumed near total control of Markowitz's personal and financial lives. At Hirschkopf's direction, Markowitz fired his sister from the company and severed relations with her, refusing all contact for 27 years. He had Markowitz set up a charitable foundation to which he left his entire estate, with Hirschkopf as sole executor of his will. Throughout the entire period, Markowitz was employed without pay as Hertzkopf's effective personal assistant and house servant, including at the lavish, celebrity-studded annual summer parties Hertzkopf hosted at the Hamptons' house. Through all these extortive intrusions, Markowitz continued to pay outlandishly high fees for his sessions. At least as disturbing as these brazen violations of the therapeutic contract is the fact that Markowitz explicitly consented to them all. How could a psychotherapist effect such a radical and sustained surrender of a patient's personal autonomy? The initial approach to a therapist activates a strange paradox. The adult patient makes a mature and reasoned decision to seek help for their suffering. But once they do, the therapeutic situation arouses feelings of intense dependency. The therapist has to receive and to bear this state of dependency. They cannot try to banish the patient's infantility and demand they grow up, but nor can they cynically enlist that dependency to their own advantage by assuring the patient that they'll take care of everything. Markowitz is clear on this point. The invitation to surrender mind and selfhood to his therapist was very comforting to him, an instantaneous provision of an ideal parent. Who could resist it? Like Faust, Hertzkopf called up the occult powers of transference, conjuring into visibility the helpless infant, ordinarily concealed in the adult's unconscious, and making it an instrument of his own self-interest. But how did this surrender become so total for so long? It was only when Hertzkopf failed to visit Markowitz in hospital following a hernia operation that the previously impregnable balloon of his idealization was popped, putting an end to his massive psychic investment in the fantasy of his therapist's curative benignity. It took a single, thoughtlessly inflicted narcissistic injury to do what decades of cynical expropriation of mind and money could not. The brazen and violent thefts and humiliations, it seems, could be integrated into a narrative of cure. And the longer they continued, the more Markowitz had to lose the moment he allowed the scales to fall. Hertzkopf, one suspects, knew this and made it part of his bold gambit. Hertzkopf is the author of a number of self-help books, notably a self-published 2003 book on anger, Hello Darkness, My Old Friend, Embracing Anger to Heal Your Life, which may cast some intriguing if oblique light on his motives and methods. Its basic premise is that perceiving and appropriately expressing anger is healthy. Hertzkopf shows his readers how to maintain steadily controlled contact with their anger so as to ensure it serves their own interest and enhances good relationships. At the heart of this conception of anger management is a fantasy of full self-possession and mastery. Hertzkopf's illustrative anecdotes, especially when they feature himself, are exemplars of the delicate tightrope walk between directness and control. At a party, a friend's mother declares herself a member of an unnamed cult, likely Scientology, and tells Hertzkopf, "Psychiatrists are the lowest form of life. You're worse than a murderer." Hertzkopf feels outrage welling up in him, but his external response is to stand up and announce he's going to get some water. His friend praises his adroit handling of the situation. However wild the horse of anger may be, Hertzkopf is always confident of keeping it under his command. What, he asks, differentiates the healthy, constructive expression of anger from its unhealthy, destructive expression? Healthy anger, he answers, involves a focus on changing the future rather than ruminating on the past, and having a finite end point after which the anger ceases rather than continuing interminably. But the spirit of the drive is precisely one of interminable continuation. As Freud reminds us, something in its nature doesn't admit of satisfaction. I'm reminded of this when I imagine the breathless seriality of the rows of celebrity selfies on the walls of the Hamptons' house. Isn't this an expression of the drive's demand continuing interminably, forever seeking the elusive object that will bring its desire the resolution it craves? Someday, the wall seems to say, we'll display a photo here enviable enough to allow us finally to stop displaying photos. The podcast reveals that both Hertzkopf and Markowitz are children of Holocaust survivors. Hertzkopf had written a column in a Jewish newspaper which described being beaten by his father. Markowitz grew up in an atmosphere of prohibition and silence around the trauma that conditioned his family's life. The experience of radical deprivation produced in one a raging hunger for recognition and compensation, in the other a sense of chronic insufficiency, where an abundance of material resources only amplified the bottomless lack of inner resources. Hirschkopf commends us to embrace anger as a fire that warms, but used it as a fire that burns. He employed it to arouse the sleeping anger of his patient, who dutifully played out his repertory of resentments against his family, and to extract the vacation home and vast inheritance and glamorous celebrity friends, those fantasized debts that can never be settled. It wasn't only Markowitz, we learn without surprise, that fell into the same relationship of deepest dependency with Hirschkopf. Various patients disclosed their private injuries and vulnerabilities, which were enlisted by their therapist, not in the service of self-understanding, but for the aggrandizement of his own power. What made Hirschkopf so dangerous was not that he didn't understand transference, but that he did. He had a confidence in its total power that might make any self-doubting, ordinarily neurotic analyst blush. This is what enabled him to capture his patients' minds and lives so completely. Perhaps this drama of total control and submission can tell us a little about the major phenomenon of global politics of the last decade, the rise of the strongman leader. Just as Markowitz elected to consult Hirschkopf and willingly participated in the latter's takeover of his rights and autonomy, so electorates in Russia, the US, Hungary, Brazil, Turkey, India, and the Philippines chose leaders who explicitly promised to curtail freedoms and rights of dissent and normalize institutional discrimination against minorities. And, like Hirschkopf, the leaders in question persuaded their subjects that these restrictions on their lives were, in fact, enlargements of them. The strongman leader and the opportunistic psychotherapist employ the same method. Identify the vulnerability of their subjects and pledge to protect it from marauding migrants or envious family members, from a shady political elite or an assertive friend or lover, all the while exacerbating that vulnerability. The more insecure the citizen or patient feels in the face of these enemy forces, the more they will cleave to their idealized leader or therapist. In his 1960 paper, Aggressivity, the French psychoanalyst Daniel Lagache posited that a basic propensity to aggression drives human life and relationships. To live in a world of others is to be caught up in the knots of domination and submission. The fundamental interhuman reality, claims Lagache, is the conflict of each person's needs and desires, what he calls their narcissism, with everyone else's. We need only watch a toddler's meltdown when refused a favourite sweet, or two siblings fighting furiously over a plastic toy, to recognise the difficulty of tolerating the existence of demands or desires other than our own. At our own narcissistic core, other people are just obstacles to us getting what we want, barriers in the way of our satisfaction, provocateurs of our aggression. One key task of individual and social development is to tame that aggression by sending it underground, below the surface of consciousness, leaving it to bubble away and erupt to the surface in endless different guises, which may include criminality, violence and terror, greed, manipulation and exploitation, cruelty and humiliation, different ways of saying the same thing. I count, you don't. It might seem as though this psychoanalytic picture of the human species, with its unmistakable echoes of Machiavelli and Hobbes, can only lead us to reactionary political conclusions. If liberty is only a spur to conflict, and equality and fraternity are naive delusions, surely the overriding political imperative is to maintain social order by whatever means necessary. From the perspective of our primitive aggression, we are each surrounded by enemies, soldiers in Hobbes' War of All Against All, uncompromisingly belligerent precisely because we are so helplessly vulnerable. The strong man intuits this paradox and exploits it. Having identified his angry, disenfranchised constituency, he names their enemies: the metropolitan elite, the deep state, the woke warriors and snowflakes, and promises their victimhood will soon be transformed into triumph. Embracing Anger to Heal Your Life runs the subtitle to Hirschkopf's book, a nice formulation for a strong man of the psyche. Hirschkopf worked on his patient with the same manipulative skill that Trump roused his base, arousing and stoking Markowitz's anger by touching the sore spot of his anxieties and insecurities. The rage that was meant to repair the cracks in his self and relationships only widened and deepened them. Ordinary family disputes took on the dimensions of an epic battle for survival that could be won only by extreme measures, cutting off relations with his family, handing over his finances, his home, and his very selfhood to his therapist. Markowitz's ordinary frustrations with family and colleagues were harnessed by Hirschkopf as an energy he commanded to place the patient entirely in his power. But his astonishing political trick, so redolent of the authoritarian leader, was to pass off this total domination as Markowitz's personal liberation. This demagogic manipulation of anger is often referred to as a form of cynicism. But how has cynicism become a byword for the calculated exploitation of others' vulnerability and credulity? In its first philosophical forms, cynicism meant something very different, almost the inverse of the sense we now give it. The first cynic philosophers and our own cynical politicians see the human being as haunted by the same frailties, but they come to very different conclusions as to what to do about this problem. Born around 410 BC in the Black Sea town of Sinope, Diogenes was the first proponent of cynic, derived from syn, the Greek word for dog, philosophy. As none of his writings survive, we learn of his teachings largely by way of reportage from later historians, and above all from Diogenes Laertius' Lives of the Eminent Philosophers, written around 6 centuries later. Much of Diogenes' teaching is distilled in the form of anecdotage. As the enemy of all propriety and conformity, he led a life of radical self-sufficiency, minimizing his needs for food, clothing, and shelter, begging without shame when he needed to, respecting no hierarchies, and bowing to no authority above him. The most famous vignette has him visited by a fascinated Alexander the Great, who asks him if there is anything he could do for him. In Plutarch's version of the story, Diogenes grunts, "Yes, shift a bit out of my sun." Diogenes Laertius writes that when asked why he would call himself a dog, syn, he replied, "I fawn on people who give me alms, I bark at them if they refuse me, and I snap at scoundrels." As a dog snapping at scoundrels, Diogenes is the model for speaking truth to power. Defecating and masturbating in public on the example of his canine inspiration, he is free of the large burden of shame instilled by social training. Unencumbered by status or possessions, he has nothing to lose, and therefore nothing to fear. Diogenes wants to dispense with need and shame because it is these forces above all that make human beings vulnerable and fearful. Because we hate these feelings, we do everything we can to attain power over those around us. But unlike Diogenes, we can't display our aggression openly for fear of retaliation and loss. Instead of making our minds and bodies stronger and more self-sufficient, we seek to wrap ourselves in defensive layers of power and luxury. Power, in the form of money, high-placed allies, and social status, assures us that we can't be harmed. Luxury, like high thread count linen, interposes layers of protection between ourselves and the hostile elements, allowing us to forget the infant self we once were, helpless against the depredations of hunger and cold. The problem with power and luxury, though, is that they beget a constant state of desire to maintain and enhance them, which is only exacerbated by the fear of losing them. This predicament is nicely outlined in The Cynic, a dialogue written in the Socratic style by the Greek writer Lucian around 500 years after Diogenes. Reading the dialogue, it's surprising to find in it an amusing homily often quoted by Freud, whose source wasn't Lucian but a series of Yiddish folk tales of the hapless everyman Itzig. Both versions of the story tell of a man who mounts a wild horse that straightaway dashes off furiously. A pedestrian on the road asks him where he's going as the horse flashes by. "That's up to the horse," replies the man. More intriguing still is that Lucian and Freud use the story to the same purpose, to show that the obscure desires that impel us forward, what Freud calls the drives, are carrying us to unknown and potentially dangerous destinations, even and especially when we think they are under our control. Now, says the cynic of Lucian's dialogue, if someone asks you where you're off to, if you're honest, you will simply say that your desires will decide, the desires of pleasure, greed, and ambition. Then anger, or some other emotion like fear, seems to direct you. For you are on the back, not of one, but of many horses, and different ones at different times, but all of them out of control, which is why you end up in ditches or falling off cliffs. And you have no presentiment that any such calamity awaits you. Cynicism was a bid to put limits on the human drives, to forge a mode of life that wouldn't be plagued by perpetual dissatisfaction. Impelled by vanity and grandiosity, the breathless pursuit of happiness succeeds only in making us angrier and more fearful. On this reading, should we not place Greta Thunberg squarely in the cynic tradition? The adolescent who stands in a t-shirt before the world's richest and most powerful operators and mouths all the empty pieties of corporate green orthodoxy. Innovation, cooperation and willpower. Green jobs. Smooth transition. Before interrupting herself with mocking iterations of the same phrase. Blah, blah, blah. It is not just her fearless ridicule that places Thunberg in the cynic tradition. In unmasking the solutions of technocratic political and business leaders as disguised exacerbations of the problems, shifty ways of evading the effects of their own power, she is following in the logic of cynical argumentation. We might say that Thunberg's 2021 speech in Milan pits her ancient cynicism against the modern cynicism of the political and business classes. Like Diogenes, she starts from the premise that power today harbours within itself a fatal weakness, namely a phobic horror of questioning itself, a refusal to contemplate any break on its own appetites. World leaders would rather risk humanity's survival than advocate lower levels of mass consumption. Ancient cynicism proposes that if the satisfaction human beings are so haplessly and perpetually chasing can never be realised, they should stop running and seek instead to place strict limits on the scope of their desire. Modern cynicism takes this same perpetual dissatisfaction and enlists it in the service of power. The modern cynic is concerned neither to remedy nor to eliminate dissatisfaction. Ancient cynicism's interest in human dissatisfaction fed a disinterested inquiry into the conduct of life most conducive to rationality and spiritual integrity. The modern cynic, the politician, the advertiser, the lobbyist, realizes that the same insights into dissatisfaction can be leveraged to achieve their political and economic interests. Their interest is rather in maintaining dissatisfaction, in stoking his constituents' perpetual anger, for which the cynic politician becomes figurehead, directing it at corruptions and injustices being perpetuated in places too impenetrable and elusive ever to be reached. Trump and his MAGA movement employ a language of calculated vagueness in naming their enemies. The deep state, the global elite, the woke army, interlocking networks of conspirators against the real America, injecting the nation with the insidious poisons of migrant hordes, vaccines, radicalism and godlessness, while depriving it of jobs, guns and petrol. The places from which these poisons are being administered become ever more diffuse and inaccessible, culminating in the fantasies of the QAnon movement, which trades on a story of a heroic Trumpist agent's imminent exposure and prosecution of the hidden satanic paedophile cabal running all governmental institutions. It is often remarked that by doing nothing to disconfirm this excitable nonsense, Trump and his acolytes facilitate its dangerous spread. But less remarked is their never having made any attempt to confirm it. This may seem obvious. To give explicit credence to QAnon's claims would surely be politically suicidal even for Trump. But more importantly, Trump's near silence creates the atmosphere most favourable to QAnon's spread and growth. To the movement's followers, it signals a tacit confirmation of the conspiracy's truth. It also protects the story from fact-checking pedantry. By remaining silent on its specific claims, Trump ensures they remain in an obscure outland beyond the reach of all proofs, positive or negative. For true believers, every appeal to the discernible facts, there is no Q, the Democratic Party is not a secret paedophile ring, only confirms the nefarious concealment of the real facts. Cynicism mobilizes conspiracy theory not to explain or enlighten, but to sustain and deepen mass dissatisfaction. The cynical politician makes a peculiar virtue of the fact that the injustices they decry are defined by the impossibility of obtaining any redress for them. You can't hunt down the paedophiles or expose election fraud because such crimes are defined by their perpetrators' capacity to cover their own tracks, because the systems that should be finding and punishing them are under their secret command. This means that their followers are denied the satisfaction they crave and demand. The advantage of this denial is that it ensures they remain in a state of permanently unassuaged anger, providing the cynic with a precious and endlessly renewable resource. If anger is the political gift that keeps on giving, the trick is to keep it flowing. To achieve redress would risk switching off the tap. But denied satisfaction is an ambiguous gift. Let's recall once more that for psychoanalysis, the human being can only endure so much dissatisfaction. Once the state of heightened tension induced by it reaches a certain pitch in us, we feel helplessly compelled to discharge it in one way or another. The January 6th attack on the Capitol was an instance of this compulsion. The campaign of election denial waged by Trump and his team of slapstick litigants fueled a mass rage too voracious and too extreme to be contained by mere words or sentiments. The nervous system cannot support tension on this scale indefinitely. It is impelled to find a way to discharge it in real-world action. As sexual arousal demands urgent discharge in orgasm, so anger eventually demands urgent discharge in aggression. As the permanent threat of rebellion and the unrealized promise of retribution, anger is the cynical politician's lifeblood. In the aftermath of that day, it seemed as though by encouraging the passage from mass anger to mass violence, Trump had handled the cynical politician's kryptonite. For a while, the image of puddles and piles of excrement reportedly deposited by the insurrectionists in the Capitol hallways resembled an allegory of Trump's hubris. For as long as it spread unhindered through the immaterial conduits of the airwaves and internet, the stolen election narrative was political gold. Once it invaded the physical center of American power, it quickly turned to shit. At least, that is what liberals and leftists, including myself, desperate as ever to consign Trumpian populism to the dustbin of history, told themselves the world over. This reverse alchemy, we insisted, began the moment Trump appeared not only to exploit the rumors of a stolen election, but to believe them. Instead of letting the election results float in the ether of doubt and ambiguity, he aggressively proclaimed their fraudulence. His press secretary appeared on TV brandishing random stacks of paper, said to be irrefutable evidence of election fraud. His personal lawyer brought a farcical succession of failed legal challenges to the results, eventually telling an Arizona official, "We've got lots of theories, we just don't have the evidence." Surely, I told myself as I watched these events unfold, there is no coming back from this. Surely, as soon as political cynicism stakes itself on a claim to verifiable truth, it is deprived of one of its key resources, the unfalsifiability of its own claims. As soon as you say, "This is true, and I intend to prove it," you are no longer an authentic cynic. You are forced to operate in the relatively narrow confines of shared reality against which your words will be tested. Febrile rumour can sustain popular anger while leaving just enough ambiguity to prevent it from spilling over into aggression. But once rumour has morphed into a claim to truth, anger is bound to shade into aggression. This is what happened at the Capitol. Movements fronted by cynical leaders live off a diffuse, free-floating rage directed against nefarious and elusive enemies. Once that rage crosses over into actual aggression, the movement runs ahead of its leadership. As the insurrectionists stormed the Capitol, Trump could only bear witness to them gormlessly on TV. His silence during those hours signaled not the wily ambiguity of the cynic, but the helpless panic of the cornered rat. The one thing he couldn't do was hide, either from his opponents or from his devotees. When he was railroaded the next day into an unconvincingly presidential televised condemnation of the heinous attack on the US Capitol, expressing his outrage at the violence, lawlessness, and mayhem, and calling for a revitalization of the sacred bonds of love and loyalty that bind us together, there could have been very few, whether followers or opponents of Trump, who did not see through its phony pieties. What made the statement so transparently insincere was the knowledge of every viewer that Trump believed the election to have been stolen. And to one who believes, or indeed knows, that the American people were defrauded by a tightly concealed and concerted network of shadowy operators, the act of insurrection is as reasonable as it is proportionate. So why on earth would you condemn it? Angrily denouncing the swamp, or the system, Trump, in the time-honoured manner of the cynic, likes to pose as a cynic, speaking lies to the powerless under cover of speaking truth to power. The political problem for Trump was that for his followers, the increasing psychic effort of splitting off the lies was manageable only by way of escape into a fantasy world like QAnon. Living in a tightly conceived conspiratorial illusion in which your leader is the world's imminent saviour may be the only way to shield yourself from seeing the tediously rambling, shabbily opportunistic old man who bears his name. This seemed to be the conclusion of Trump's donors and voters in the 2 years following the insurrection, as his political star slowly but inexorably faded. What hopeful liberal commentators failed to anticipate was the supreme flexibility of Trumpian cynicism, the massive political advantage that accrues to the candidate freed from obligations to truth or consistency. Trump became increasingly mired in multiple state and federal indictments for his role in fomenting the January 6th insurrection, promising a fitting climax to his downfall. These indictments have proved instead to be the motor of his revival. Having let his base run ahead of him, Trump set about making up the lost ground, transforming the political dross of the insurrectionists' mass prosecutions and his own legal jeopardy back into electoral gold. He countered the irrefutable falsifications of all claims of election interference by leaning into them ever more aggressively. Under his Midas touch, established facts were remade as inventions of deep state and Democrat enemies, with Trump self-cast as their martyr and avenging angel. We have been returned to the world in which Trump's every claim is unfalsifiable and all documentary evidence unverifiable, to a soil perfectly primed for the sowing and eventual harvesting of infinite reserves of mass anger. Over the last decade or so, Vladimir Putin has leaned increasingly on an openly autocratic rhetoric to justify the suppression of all opposition and dissent, imprisoning and murdering political opponents at home and abroad, brutally putting down mass protests, shutting down media outlets that subject his regime to critical scrutiny, gazing down broodingly on adoring, flag-waving crowds, he edges ever closer to the model totalitarian ruler. Above all, of course, he has waged a war of murderous aggression on Ukraine in the name of a revived Russian imperialism, which, as I write, shows no signs of abating. Trump's admiration for Putin and other autocratic rulers and regimes is likely rooted in envy of their freedom to override norms that fail to serve their interests. His predicament, shown most vividly by the broad comedy of his failed legal challenges, is that he is obliged to operate in democratic institutions, and so is subject to norms such as the burden of proof and political accountability. It's worth recalling that Putin himself was democratically elected, that when his presidency started life, he was fated as an economic and geopolitical ally by Tony Blair, George W. Bush, and many other Western leaders. The Western political establishment saw Putin building and cultivating the institutional and legal structures of a democratic state. Hindsight shows us that he was presiding over something closer to a cynical pastiche of democracy, an ingenious mimicry of its basic mechanisms and conventions. When the clothes of democracy are so thin, it's much easier to shed them and reveal the naked autocracy that's always lurked beneath. When he emerged from political obscurity in 1999 to be anointed Boris Yeltsin's successor by a closed circle of oligarchs and Kremlin insiders, Putin had somehow to ride the wave of free-floating, disorganized mass rage manifesting in the noisy convergence of nationalist, neo-fascist and communist revivalist protest against the chaos-inducing market reforms of the previous decade. It would not be enough for Putin merely to weather the storm of this rage. If he was to sustain his power in Russia, he would need to harness it to make himself its champion and representative. But how to appease a populace traumatized and enraged by poverty and lawlessness? Sincere appeals for patience and endurance will have little effect on the hungry, as we saw from revolutionary France. Politicians like Trump and Putin harness anger by driving cynicism to its outer limit. They hit on a deep seam of anger that has no agreed-upon cause or object. This anger is directed instead to a conveniently plastic range of essentially fictive provocations: immigrants, paedophiles, the radical left, abolitionists of gender, the EU, the US, the West. Mass rage is dispersed, a floating resource liable to capture by the highest bidder, for whom it serves as an endlessly renewable reserve of political capital. The conjuring up of imaginary enemies is central to the cynical project. It creates a political atmosphere in which reality itself is fictive, in which the world is described not in accordance with the finite field of facts, but with the infinitely malleable stuff of fantasies and wishes. What could be a more efficacious path to political domination than to manage the hard matter of reality as though it were the airy, weightless stuff of art? To preside over a political territory as though it were one's own imaginary playground, that may be the definition of total sovereignty. In his 1949 essay, Literature and the Right to Death, Maurice Blanchot presents the French Revolution in just these terms. Revolutionary action, he writes, is in every respect analogous to action as embodied in literature, the passage from nothing to everything. What Blanchot means is that just as literature can make a living reality out of weightless marks on a blank page, the revolutionary terror did the same in reverse. It took living reality and turned it back into pure abstraction, making reality unreal. Specifically, the terror turned individual human beings into empty abstractions, transforming them instantaneously from living, breathing citizens into anonymous ciphers whose substance consisted solely in whether they were perceived as allies or enemies of the revolution. Under the terms of the terror, a citizen could be casually decapitated because the revolution had already deprived them of their life by killing the individuality that defined them as alive. They could be killed with a novelist's breeziness in killing off a character. Every totalitarian regime seeks for this reason to bathe itself in the ether of the aesthetic, to turn society into a total work of art, an artifice to be made and remade at will. From this perspective, Trump's failure to capture the machinery of the state looks like a kind of aesthetic indiscipline. His breathless excitability was incompatible with the ruthless auteurist mastery required for the task. Were he given to learning, he might glean a lot from a man who executed this capture with startling success for over a decade. Putin's chief political technologist, Vladislav Surkov, who, beginning in the late 1990s, conjured up a model of fictive governance he called, not without irony, sovereign democracy. Like Trump after him, Surkov's feat was to identify a bottomless political resource in the disorganized rage that was overwhelming Russia. Occupying a succession of high offices until his first political excommunication in 2012, Surkov directed Russian society like one great reality show, as writer and propaganda expert Peter Pomerantsev puts it. Surkov oversaw the effectively permanent installation of the ruling United Russia Party, while creating its opposition, nominally independent parties of the left and right, whose policies and votes he micromanaged to best serve the interests of the Kremlin. Surkov's sovereign democracy centralized all political speech and activity. Movements and parties financed by the Kremlin would then be in permanent political debt to it, bound by its interests, subject to its instruction. He became an artist on Blanchot's model of the revolutionary. Nationalist or communist parties that appeared to carry an inheritance of history and ideology were reduced by him to mere simulacra of real political entities whose speech and activity were fed harmlessly back into the order they appeared to contest. Central to Surkov's painstakingly curated mythology is his literary and theatrical education and links to Russia's bohemian art circles. In a 2021 interview with Henry Foy, he recounts his training in the commedia dell'arte tradition as a kind of metaphorical apprenticeship in political management. People need to see themselves on stage. In this masked comedy, there is a director, there is a plot, and this is when I understood what needed to be done. Commedia dell'arte involves a limited range of stock characters replaying plots and routines whose course is known at the outset. Similarly, the Russian opposition, along with the roiling mass discontent they were meant to represent, are now prisoners inside a play script whose occasional variations only underscore the inevitability of the outcome. In modelling it on the imaginary worlds of art and literature, Surkov turned political life into an empty spectacle, imprisoning its actors in an airless hell of repetitious illusion. In his pseudonymously published 2009 novel Almost Zero, Okolonolya, Surkov extended and further confused this traffic between literature and reality. His protagonist, Yegor, an amoral PR man who traffics in underground literature, is invested in books for their capacity to break, rather than make links between words and world. Yegor, Surkov writes, in a passage that might be channeling Blanchot, was interested in the adventures of names, not people. To be a name, rather than a person, is to be reduced to a decorporealized abstraction in a world without differences, where the lines marking one thing off from another dissolve. What remains is reality as raw matter to be perpetually made, unmade and remade by whoever seizes hold of it. And as Blanchot's revolution showed us, the paradox of this new, egoless, incorporeal perspective is that it prepares the way for limitless violence. Surkov first fell out of favour with Putin in 2012, when the strings of his marionette theatre seemed to slip through his fingers. The oppositional groups he had seamlessly directed and controlled finally assumed a life of their own, turning on his stage management and breaking through his fourth wall. When thousands of protesters broke with his script and took to the streets of Moscow, Surkov declined to order a crackdown. Rumours proliferated of his covert sympathy for the opposition. At very least, he seemed to see the protests as the inevitable breakdown of his rule of illusion. Surkov's consequent dismissal paved the way for Putin's regime to drop its contrived facade of plural democracy and expose the brutal autocracy that had always lurked behind it. But that was by no means the end of Surkov. In 2014, he resurfaced in Ukraine, as historian Timothy Snyder recounts, in The Road to Unfreedom, to foment violence against the Maidan opposition and stir up pro-Russian separatist agitation in Crimea. The day after his arrival on February the 15th, live ammunition was distributed to Ukrainian riot police. While awaiting the outcome of a parliamentary discussion of constitutional compromise, protesters on the Maidan were surprised by massive and lethal violence. In November 2021, after 6 years leading covert operations to destabilize Ukraine and presiding over the self-styled separatist republics in the Donbass, Surkov wrote an article conceptualizing these operations as the simple logic of physics, specifically the law of entropy, famously formulated by James Clerk Maxwell. In 1999, Surkov writes, Putin inherited a country and system running headlong into entropic decay and chaos, and stabilized its economy and governance. But, he continues, if the second law of thermodynamics is true, and it is true, then entropy can never be conjured away. It is in the nature of every closed system to generate entropy, raising the question of what to do with it. Surkov's answer is, as he openly acknowledges, the cynical recourse of every struggling empire. Export the chaos elsewhere. The socially toxic entropic energies aroused by and against Putin's regime have been diverted to Ukraine in a new iteration of a venerable imperial strategy. Exporting chaos is nothing new. Divide and conquer is an ancient recipe. Rally your own plus divide others equals you will rule both. 3 months later, Russia invaded Ukraine. But cynicism doesn't merely exploit popular anger. It gives a facade of sneering invulnerability, perfectly concentrated in an unofficial slogan that appeared during the Trump 2020 campaign, Fuck Your Feelings. The irony of the slogan is that right-wing populism draws all its force from feelings. The MAGA movement's appeal is to the anger and bitterness of constituencies afflicted by industrial decline and its attendant effects of lost economic security, as well as declining social and cultural prestige. Trump promised a magical reversal of these losses, famously assuring a rally in 2016, "We're going to win so much, you're going to be sick and tired of winning." But lurking in that sentence is the present reality it inverts. that you're losing so much you're sick and tired of losing. The alchemy by which losing turns into winning is as much emotional as it is political. It transforms depressive feelings of inadequacy and vulnerability into a state of total triumph. One of the most striking revelations of Men Who Hate Women, Laura Bates's Anatomy of Contemporary Forms of Misogyny, is the extent to which the leadership of online male supremacist groups is conditioned by deep contempt. Alongside the predictably vicious bile directed against women, we see a smirking disgust for the smallest hints of weakness in men. Paul Elam is a leading light of the Men's Rights Awareness, MRA, movement, a network of mostly online groupings pathologically hostile to feminism, not to mention to women in general. When he received hundreds of contacts from men claiming to have been screwed over or ruined by some or other aspect of our anti-male society, he didn't respond with the assuring solidarity his correspondents might have expected. Instead, he wrote a blog post entitled "An Open Response to Troubled Men," in which he told these embittered victims to go fucking bother someone else with your problems. It seems it is not enough to hate feminism or even actual women. The true MRA warrior hates the smallest intimation of feminine tendencies, above all an openness to painful or difficult feelings in all human beings, and works tirelessly to eliminate all traces of them in himself. This turns out to be a common feature of an array of militantly anti-feminist movements across the web. The stamp of authenticity in such groups is a tone of snarling mockery towards any member who shows any hint of weakness or self-doubt. As the saying goes, fuck your feelings. This slogan was no flippant joke. It was a precisely calculated rhetorical move, distilling the essence of the MAGA movement. It is hardly a surprise to discover just how much crossover there is between the leading figures of online Trumpism and of militant anti-feminism. They are interlocking parts of a single vision of a world over which hardened alpha men preside, ruthlessly coercing women and weaker men into the service of their needs and desires. This is the context in which online groups boasting tens of thousands of members share their convictions in the natural justice of the domestic abuse and rape of women. The aim here is to be angry in a particular style, what American writer Andrew Marantz aptly calls mirth with a base note of rage. The mirth has a paradoxical effect of at once amplifying the rage and calling it into doubt. It is amplified because laughter and jokes license levels of aggression in the speaker that are impermissible in ordinary conversation. It is called into doubt because it's just a joke, and failing to laugh along reveals not how cruel the joker is, but how humorless you are. Take a vignette told by Marantz about Gavin McInnes, alt-right provocateur and founder of the Proud Boys. Marantz followed a crew of alt-right semi-celebrities led by McInnes to the Deplorable, a celebration of Trump's impending presidency, the night before Trump's inauguration in January 2017. On his way in, McInnes punched an Antifa protester in the face, later on telling a news crew, "I think the one I punched him, my fist went into his mouth and his teeth scraped me on the way out. Now I might get loser AIDS." The joke is set up to neutralize the outrage of the listener in advance. Its cruelty and crassness are so brazen, so overblown as to imply that no one should take it seriously. And this is the point. On the alt-right web, to take words or ideas or even policies seriously, to commit yourself to them, to have strong feelings about them, is to make yourself laughable. The notional ideal of the alt-right man is to treat political ideas largely as he treats, or likes to claim to treat, women, as expedient instruments for serving the needs of the moment. The cynic politician, like the cynic therapist, has discovered anger as a resource to master and exploit. They both offer the dubious solace of an invulnerable father and a community united in shared rage. This may bring into focus why so much of this shared rage orbits around women and sexuality. The right populist leader promises a world of perfectly rigid paternal control, in which all insubordination receives a casual punch in the face and everyone and everything is in and knows its place. Mirth in such a setup is a way of signalling that you are in full command of your own rage, that your power consists precisely in your capacity not to care, not to succumb to the weak-willed sentimentality that afflicts women. This, in turn, makes sense of how so many of the mirthful provocateurs of the alt-right are also tricksters and trolls, disseminating manifestly delusional conspiracies like Pizzagate. The two roles share the same relationship to truth. Only weak-stomached women and womanish men are still credulous enough to care about it. The authentically strong man can say anything without needing it to be true. Before and during Trump's presidency, many of these alt-right figures were writing and broadcasting for Russian media outlets, the avant-garde of post-truth politics. As Surkoff's career showed us, with enough ingenuity and effort, factual truth can be effectively eliminated from the political sphere, creating a vacancy to be filled instead by the story Putin once told. Insofar as the entire space of politics is commandeered by one regime, Russia is very different from the US, perhaps enviably so for the MAGA extremists forced to share political space with those who think differently. Rageful mirth is a means of compensating for this unfortunate circumstance. Unlike Putin, MAGA warriors don't enjoy the privilege of imprisoning or killing their opposition. Instead, they can create an atmosphere which annihilates the human significance of their opponents, turning them into nothing more than the butt of a joke. Putin certainly likes to mock from on high, but he doesn't deign to clown or joke. With the entire state machinery at his disposal to crush all dissent, he doesn't need to. He presides over a population fed a steady diet of state propaganda, starved of all alternative sources of information, and cowed into submission by the threat of arrest should they publicly question or protest his rationale for the so-called special military operation in Ukraine. This near total power over the citizenry undergirds Putin's portrayal of Russia as sole bulwark against the decadence of the West, expressed above all in its obsessional hatred for the gender and sexual equality movements. Timothy Snyder notes that Putin's regime has long been gripped by an obsessive hostility towards Western sexual permissiveness and its threat to traditional values. As Russian troops mobilized to invade Crimea in 2014, Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov published an article presenting Russia as the real victim of the conflict with the West. According to Lavrov, the true aggressors were the international gay lobbyists. In a screed of 2021 presenting Trump as a hero of the war against globalist technocracy, Putin's court philosopher and obscurantist neo-fascist Alexander Dugin proposes that the real aim of the movement for gender rights is to dehumanize the individual by divesting them of any distinctive biological characteristics. In fact, Dugin claims, progressive gender politics is a central plank of an elaborate Western scheme to replace humans, albeit partially, by cyborgs, artificial intelligence networks, and products of genetic engineering. The optional human logically follows optional gender. One of the finely honed traits of Putinist and Trumpian rhetoric alike is the perpetual inversion of the positions of victim and aggressor. It is Putin, leader of a regime now unambiguously fascist in its philosophical lineage and its practice, who perpetually labels his enemies and victims fascists. It is Dugin who proposes banishing women to the home and gay people to the closet. But somehow, it is the feminist and LGBT movements who are accused of dehumanization. This is the advantage of abolishing a shared reality. It enables the speaker to bend reality, now weightless and pliable, to their will. The MAGA movement and Putin regime share the same wish to restore a fixed order of gender and sexual power. This aspiration isn't confined to the conspiratorial inventions of Democrat-run paedophile rings. American conservative groups have in recent years forged a concerted strategy to reverse the teaching of sexual equality, including gay and trans rights, in schools by attacking school board members with the noxious slur of groomer, equating an inclusive sex education with child abuse. Why this obsessive recurrence of these fantasies of the enemy's pathological sexuality? These projections of extreme perversity and aggression emanate from the deep unconscious of the conspiracy mongers themselves. The imputations of the other's degeneracy, the ideals of a traditional gender and sexual hierarchy cleansed of all deviations, the contemptuous mockery of weak men and strong women, all speak to a terror of sex as a force of internal danger and chaos that must be brought under control. It's this terror and the rage it arouses that a cynical politics seeks to exploit, promising to restore order to a world disordered by sexual equality and freedom. But such promises are risky, for like the Stop the Steal protests, they depend on arousing and nursing an anger that can easily tip over into aggression. While the rage of the incel against women for declining to service his sexual needs is discharged in online rants, it remains a political resource. But once that rage impels him to shoot actual women, the rage is no longer usable. Bates notes that Trump's long-term advisor, alt-right guru Steve Bannon, had identified the potential political value of incels in 2016, enlisting the services of Cambridge Analytica to target them as a constituency that could have a massive impact in swing states. But it's essential that relationships like this remain ambiguous and plausibly deniable. Bannon is too canny an operator to make an explicit endorsement of incel and MRA groups. By drawing them into a quiet alliance, keeping them close enough to use and far enough to disavow, he is able to draw on their rage as a political resource, as the Trump campaign did with a diverse range of hate groups and far-right leaders. Keeping such relationships ambiguous effectively allows Bannon to harness the anger of such groups while repudiating their aggression. As we saw in relation to the January 6th insurrection, when anger passes into real-world aggression, disappointment and bitterness are bound to follow, because the action that is supposed to effect the desired change fails to do so. The incel shooter excitedly imagines he'll terrorize women into submission to male authority, but his actions produce only grief and horror. The utopia of straight white male supremacy he and his online cheerleaders hope for is never achieved. The cynic's promises are revealed in all their craven emptiness. It strikes me that Gerard's rage fueled a kind of one-man war against the cynicism he saw all around him. The dating apps and the politicians drew so much of his fury because they preyed on human vulnerability, especially his own. In his mind, he was perpetually at the edge of some new humiliation, of being exposed as stupid, naive, desperate. I suspect that without quite knowing it, he approached me with the same wish that Markowitz brought to Hertzkopf, that I would take care of everything. But Gerard and Markowitz both carry histories that make this wish very complicated. As a child, Gerard had been in awe of his father, ascribing to him an intellectual brilliance, ready wit, and debonair sophistication that made him the object of both bottomless, yearning admiration and an impossible remoteness. As a child, he had felt he could never gain his father's attention, interest, concern, or curiosity. If he tried to show his father some creative work, or confide in him about problems at school, or ask him questions about the world, he was met with a look of glazed distraction, which would reliably turn into irritability if Gerard pressed his case. "Gerard, you can see I'm very busy. We can discuss this later," he'd respond, audibly gritting his teeth. Gerard quickly learned that later would never arrive, that the moment of paternal recognition he craved would only be deferred once again. He would take some of his questions and concerns to his mother, who was at least warm and responsive, but she too was invested in her husband as the one who knows, the ultimate stamp of authority and approval, next to which anything she could say meant very little. "Oh dear, Jerry," she replied when he revealed he was being bullied, "that's too awful, you poor thing. We'll talk to your father about it tonight. He'll know what to do." Gerard and his mother formed a kind of implicitly abandoned family, passively awaiting the return of a patriarch to direct and instruct them. The problem was that the patriarch had never left, but neither had he ever really been there. The desperate hope that his presence would become more than a kind of ghostly physical apparition, that he would see them and affirm for them that they really existed for him, could never be realised. This sense of indefinite hiatus meant that Gerard lacked any conviction that he could act for himself. It seemed never to occur to him to get angry with his father, or to conclude that if his father was never going to show interest in him, he would need to show interest in himself. What had prevented him from letting his father see his disappointment and anger was the terror that his father would retaliate by rejecting him permanently, cutting off any possibility that Gerard might finally make real contact with him. It was this possibility that held both Gerard and his mother together. Without it, they might just unravel. In other words, Gerard was left suspended indefinitely in the hope that someone would take care of everything. He was burdened by the unconscious fantasy that his father's near total emotional neglect would be transformed into its opposite, an enveloping and inexhaustible love. It was inevitable that this hope would be transferred onto me from the moment he came to see me. But by the time he started to work with me, around the age of 40, this hope had been so long unfulfilled that it had come to express itself as a kind of permanent, weary anger. At our first meeting, I asked him what he hoped for from our work. "Isn't it obvious?" he replied testily. "I'm in a bloody mess, and I'm furious and embittered and terribly tired, and I want it to stop before it ruins the rest of my life. Do you think that's even possible? Because if it isn't, let's not waste my time or yours." Perhaps it would have felt like a huge relief for me to have replied, like Hirschkopf, that I take care of everything. It's not uncommon for a person to come to psychoanalysis secretly hoping for a promise like this, which is why it's so dangerous to make it. In pledging to reverse all the pain and damage of another's life, a therapist is only ensuring it will continue. I replied instead that I could hear how much he was suffering. I offered to work with him to try to understand why and to think about how things might change for the better. As therapeutic aims go, I'm aware these might sound deflatingly vague. For many critics of my profession, the unwillingness to set clear and defined goals only points to the cynicism of psychoanalysis. After all, with all that trying and thinking about and might, aren't I just stringing him along, dangling phantom carrots, drawing him into a vortex that sucks up time and money and hope while achieving nothing tangible? Am I not, like the cynic politician, harnessing Gerard's rage to my own advantage? It may be that the only honest answer to this question is maybe. It may well be that we work together and that months and even years will pass and he will feel no less furious and embittered and tired. But as I see it, it's precisely the absence of a guaranteed outcome that prevents psychoanalysis from shading into cynicism. In the face of feelings as overwhelming and debilitating as Gerard's, it would be pure hubris to claim you can tame them and bring them under control. These would just be fine-sounding words masquerading as action. Whereas, paradoxically, to tell someone in the grip of a tormenting fury that you're willing to receive and listen to it and think with him about it for as long as necessary is closer to a real action with real effects. It creates a world for him which didn't previously exist, in which someone else recognizes and is curious about his inner life and wants to help reflect it back to him, to give it shape and meaning. This, after all, is what has been so profoundly missing from his life from the beginning and has condemned him to the despair of a permanent and irremediable state of rage. Gerard no longer feels condemned to this state. He remains angry, but those images that used to assail me of his fury physically filling up the room, depriving me of any space to move or breathe, have gradually abated. His rage is as real as ever, but it no longer feels like some elemental force of which no questions can be asked, about which no curiosity is possible. Instead of being overwhelmed by his rage, Gerard has slowly developed a capacity in our work to represent it, that is, to understand both its source and its object. In defining the who and the what of his anger, he has come closer to perceiving not only who he is, but who he isn't angry with. His anger no longer seems to spread inexorably from one target to the next, accusing everyone and therefore no one. It isn't the case, of course, that Gerard didn't know he was angry with his father. The problem was that the father had mutated in his mind into a figure of mythically large dimensions, a judging and punitive god before whom his son could only cower and abase himself. When he began to talk about his actual father, he recovered a man with an emotional history of his own. Gerard's father did not come into the world a fully formed monster of emotional neglect and spiky contempt. He was carrying over the legacy of his own childhood neglect. His father, a shadowy figure who spent much of his time on unspecified government business abroad, had been an object of uneasy veneration for his children. In one session, Gerard recalled an exchange from around age 11 when he'd asked his father about the grandfather he'd never known. Rather than snapping back with a dismissive non-answer, as so often happened, his father stared into the middle distance, caught in a silence that felt genuinely reflective. "A look came over his face which I felt I'd never seen," said Gerard. "I realised he was sad, and I think I found that overwhelming. I suspect I had some secret belief my father had no feelings other than irritation. He stared for a long while, then said, 'When I was your age, all I knew about my father was that he was a man of great importance to his country. I didn't know what that meant at the time, only that whatever he was doing meant far more to him than me.'" Gerard continued, "Only now do I see what he was trying to tell me, that he'd never had a sense of mattering to his own father. All that prickliness and contempt he showed me, well, it still hurts, but somehow takes on a new complexion. I can see he's no demigod. He's a very damaged man." For as long as he could remember, Gerard had carried within him an amplified, exaggerated version of a punitively disdainful father, a father who spurned his child's love and need. Perceiving that this other father, too hurt and too defended against his own need to be able to take the risk of loving his child, enabled the anger he felt towards the father he had to be slowly assuaged by grief for the father he couldn't have. In encouraging and stoking popular rage, while offering no hope of meaningful redress, cynical politics deprives its followers of this grief. Like Quixote before the windmills, the devotees of conspiracies and mass hatreds can only ever tilt at hopelessly elusive targets. The cynic invests their followers in illusory aims and objects, a leader who saves the world and purges the nation of all unwanted others so heavily that they can never give them up. "Fuck your feelings" is the slogan of this refusal to mourn. It's the battle cry of those condemned to stay angry, unable to mourn what they can't have, and equally unable to turn their energies and desires to what they could have.